Good morning and welcome to Guts and Glory, the Singapore General Hospital Gastroenterology Podcast. I'm Dylan.
And I'm Ching-Han.
And I'm Andrew, and I'm pleased that you listeners are able to join us again in our podcast where we continue to provide in-depth discussion with our local experts from Singapore General Hospital. So today we have again with us a full house, and it's always exciting to have members of other departments joining us in our podcast because we always get such a diverse view of a topic that, you know, everyone struggles with. Can I just trouble Dylan just to introduce Evelyn and Kaina to our listeners?
So Dr. Evelyn Wong is an associate consultant who practices at the National Cancer Centre Singapore, as well as Changi General Hospital. Her subspecialty interests include upper gastrointestinal cancers, hepatobiliary cancers, as well as lower gastrointestinal cancers. She's also a founding member of the Adolescent and Young Adult Oncology Services at the National Cancer Centre. She aspires to use translational research studies to improve the outcomes of oncology patients. Dr. Wong also has an interest in global health and health policy. She participates actively in the global community and is currently a trainer at the SingHealth Duke NUS Global Health Institute. We also have with us Dr. Chen Kaina, who's a senior resident in the SingHealth Gastroenterology Program and is also a clinician scientist. She graduated from Duke NUS for medical school and completed her gastroenterology senior residency training. At present, she is undergoing her research year with Prof. Pierce Chow, primarily in hepatocellular carcinoma.
Kaina, why don't we start with you first? So it's been a while since you finished training, and we kind of miss you as our trainee, right? So what have you been up to since you were last a trainee? Have you been very busy with Pierce and all the work that he's been doing?
Yes. Thank you so much, Andrew, Dylan, and Ching-Han for inviting me to this podcast. I know it's been a very popular podcast, and it's really a great honor to be a guest here. Yes, I finished my exit exam, which is my formally training about 6 months ago. I started my clinician scientist research year since June 2022. And it's really quite different from what we used to be as a clinician on training on the ground. And this is a completely new world for me to explore and to learn. Basically, I feel like I started as a student again on a completely different field. But it's been quite exciting because a lot of things I see in the clinical practice now can actually have underlying mechanism being revealed in the research world, which is really exciting. And that's the reason why I want to become a clinician scientist.
Okay, great. Great stuff, Kaina. So let me just ask you a bit about your own non-work related life. Okay, so what do you usually do to unwind when you're not busy in the lab helping peers out?
Okay, well, I don't think I have anything. Unfortunately or fortunately, I have two children at home who will always keep me busy. So I have a lot of distractions from work, in fact. And so when I don't have to think about the research topics and research projects, then they will keep me busy with all various things, as you would know. My personal interest, not so frequently doing right now, is playing violin. So I used to play a lot in orchestra. But since I become a senior resident and going to be a consultant, it become busier. But I still try to do it once in a while.
I've always wanted to ask this to people who play the violin or any other musical instruments for that matter. Do you find that doing endoscopy wrecks your fingers and therefore you become a worse musician after that?
I don't think so, at least not for now. Yes, I hope not. But I guess it's interesting because I started violin since I was 5 and I stopped after I become 12 years old. After I get a certificate and everything, because the work study is too busy, schooling is too busy. But after maybe about 5-10 years later, I can still play. So the memory in the brain has been wired already, you know, and I can still play the things I learned a long time ago. It's very interesting. And endoscopy, it's okay. It does hurt my right thumb a bit, but the right hand is to hold the bowl, not playing on the left side, which is more important, so it's okay.
So based on what Kaina has told us, right? So this is also to all of you who have, I mean, gastroenterologists who have not scoped for a while. You'd be surprised when you hold the scope, all the finger movements will just come back. It's all muscle memory. So we're just robots when we do endoscopy. It all comes from the inner self and not from our own brains, right? Okay, thanks a lot, Kaina. So now, Evelyn, again, as mentioned, it's always exciting to have people from other departments joining us. And you have done quite a fair amount of non-work related things in this global health realm, right? And because we always see your name come up when we see the word global health and we see the word Sing Health, then we see Evelyn Wong, right? So what exactly is global health? I mean, in a nutshell, I'm sure it's a huge definition to get through.
Yeah, so once again, thank you very much, Andrew, Dylan, and Chinghan for inviting me to the podcast. So I'm really, really thankful and grateful that you are inviting people outside this specialty of gastro to talk about gastro-related topics, because it's always interesting to get all these opinions from different people of different fields, and more importantly, particularly since they work together. So I personally have an interest in GI oncology, and that's where I do in my day-to-day practice. On the sidelines, something that I feel for deeply as well is basically about this concept of health equity. And health equity, it's not just about ensuring that there's provision of equal or at least what's the basic resources to the different countries within Southeast Asia or internationally, but within a community as well, locally, to provide to ensure that every single community and every single individual, be it locally or internationally, receive what we consider the basic medical care and basic subspecialty care, basic oncological care or gastrointestinal care as well. That's through multiple regions, collaborative efforts, as well as international efforts, be it on creating biosimilar drugs or coming up with creative, economically sound resources. So that's where my interest lies. So that's what I've been doing for a couple of years now. With regards to oncology, my practice is mainly, like I said, in gastrointestinal cancers. So I do anything ranging from the esophagus to the gastric to the liver, as well as the colon and the rectum as well. Yeah.
So what do you do to unwind if you're not busy trying to restore equity and justice in the world or saving lives?
I mean, I would say that the truth is this is kind of like a pet topic, because this is not something that I do on my clinical day-to-day work as well. I am actually a dancer, so I have been dancing since I was the age of 3, and I still do dance at this point of time as well. So yeah, I mean, that's what I do to unwind, a good 1.5 hours of just sweating it out and then going back to work. That's what I do normally in the evenings or at least in the night times as well. Yeah, that's the only time that we can have to do some of the things that we are, interested in outside of medicine or outside of where we are working in.
So what kind of dance do you actually do, if I may ask?
So I was trained in ballet. I did it when I was 3 years old. Currently right now, I am doing a bit of contemporary, a bit of hip-hop, a bit of jazz. And I think that this is something that we should continue to learn, even though we are relatively older. I do think that, just keeping your body active and keeping the mind active at the same time, and just having some sort of a thing that we could actually go to do after work is actually good as well. Yeah.
This is something I need to tell my daughter, right? So it's she was doing ballet for a while, but I feel like ballet is an extremely expensive thing to do because they change outfits every year, and they just keep raising the prices, right?
I think you should just buy something big and let her grow into it, because it's that it's going to change color or anything. So just buy something pink, buy something big, tell her that we'll just sew it up a little bit, and then she can grow into it slowly.
Okay, sounds like a plan. All right, thanks Evelyn, thanks Kaina for all the introductions. So Chinghan, what case do we have with us today as we have our special guest to help us along with this topic?
Today our patient is Mr. Lee Fer Lam. He's a 64-year-old man who has a history of hepatitis B on follow-up with primary care. A recent ultrasound of his liver demonstrated a 1.5 cm hypoechoic nodule that was not there 6 months ago. He is otherwise asymptomatic and is being referred to the clinic for further evaluation. So to start off, I'd like to ask, how common is HCC in Singapore and where does it rank in terms of other cancers in Singapore?
So perhaps I'll take this question. I think first and foremost, we need to realize that actually more than 70% of the new cases of liver cancer are diagnosed in Asia. And that's the region that close to 70 to 80% of all those chronically infected with hepatitis B virus in the world. So within Singapore, and these centers are, and these numbers are actually taken from the recent centers between 2015 to 2019. Within the males in Singapore, this is ranked as the fourth most common cancer, as well as the third top cancer mortality. While in the females, although it's not in the top 10 most common cancers, however, it's also ranked on the fifth top cancer mortality. So I would say that in general, liver cancer is an Asian disease, and therefore, regardless of whether or not you're in oncology or gastrointestinal practice, you would still need to know a little bit about hepatocellular carcinoma, just simply because of how commonly we would see it in our Asian population.
And since you mentioned that it's actually quite common in Asia, in this region of the world, I'd like to ask, who is at risk of developing HCC?
Overall, liver cirrhosis is the biggest risk factor for HCC. One third of our patients with liver cirrhosis develop HCC during a lifetime. Therefore, it's very, very important for us to make sure all the patients with liver cirrhosis has regular follow-up and surveillance for HCC, as well as to look for liver decompensation. But cirrhosis is a long process. It developed from something that caused chronic liver disease. And the common etiology, as Evelyn just mentioned, is chronic viral hepatitis B in our part of the world. In the Western countries, hepatitis C has been one of the predominant causes. And now on the rise is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Less commonly, we have other rare etiology that may also cause liver cirrhosis, therefore HCC, including autoimmune hepatitis, primary biliary cholangitis, and so on. So as mentioned, in Singapore, chronic hepatitis B is the major cause and is usually acquired at young age from the vertical transmission. So it's important to be aware that for chronic hepatitis B patients, they don't really have to go through the phase of becoming liver cirrhosis after a long period of time to have HCC. A lot of young patients with hepatitis B can develop HCC on a background normal liver. Therefore, for all the hepatitis B patients over a certain age, like 40 years old, we do regular surveillance to make sure that we follow up and pick up HCC early. Another risk factor on the rise is fatty liver disease. This is not something we fully understand why it causes HCC. One thing we are sure is that for fatty liver patients that subsequently become liver cirrhosis are at high risk of HCC as much as other etiologies of liver cirrhosis. But by itself, fatty liver disease without having to go through cirrhosis can also cause HCC. We do see patients develop HCC from fatty liver without any single cirrhosis on the background. This is something of very active research at the moment globally because fatty liver is very prevalent and hope one day we'll have an answer to that.
Okay, Kaina, so I just want to ask you a question. You mentioned earlier that in some of the population that is at risk of HCC, you do perform some kind of surveillance. And a common way to do surveillance is to do regular ultrasound of the abdomen as well as alpha fetoprotein levels. Right. So we do get all these isolated rays, alpha fetoprotein patients coming from various sources. Could be from the polyclinic, they could come from health screening tests. What do you usually do with these patients? Is there a certain set of investigations that you do?
Yes, that's a very good question. We do see a lot of patients came in with health screening paper results to say, I have high AFP, do I have liver cancer? So unfortunately, AFP is not really a good diagnostic test for HCC. Even combining with ultrasound, like in our case with Mr. Lee, The sensitivity is only about 60% to pick up HCC, in fact. And a lot of patients have HCC, diagnosed HCC, only 40, well, there are about 40% of them have not completely normal AFP. That's why AFP is not really a good diagnostic marker for HCC at all. One common scenario we see for high AFP, for example, is someone who came in with a little bit abnormal liver function test. They probably took some medication that caused drug-induced liver injury, or they may have certain viral infection to the liver that causes inflammation. The AFP is high because the liver is actively regenerating, trying to repair the liver that's been damaged. That's why the AFP is high rather than they have a cancer. And so what do we do with this group of patients with high AFP? Number one, to assess any individual's risk of any disease for that matter, one single test is never enough. We need to synthesize all the clinical histories and take into consideration other biochemistry tests, family histories, and the imaging results to decide what is the actual risk of this person actually having a cancer. So in our case, Mr. Lee, who has known hepatitis B, if we only have a result of elevated AFP, we shouldn't ignore it because he is at high risk of developing HCC. Conversely, if there's a young female who came in, who may be pregnant, having a high AFP from pregnancy itself, then the chance of this person having liver cancer is really low. So someone with a high risk profile of HCC, we should continue with a thorough workup to exclude that liver cancer.
I just want to ask a similar question to Evelyn, right? So tumor markers, right? So they're the bane of our existence sometimes, right? Because we get all sorts of referrals for minor elevations of all these tumor markers. And sometimes we wish they weren't done. Sometimes we see the value in doing them. But what are your thoughts? Because alpha-fetoprotein is one of many tumor markers that are available. So do you recommend that people just do these tests routinely, or are they useful in certain situations? What are your thoughts, Evelyn?
Okay. So I'm aware that this podcast is also listened to by some medical students as well as perhaps some IM residents across the nations as well. So just to clarify, tumor markers is a biomarker that we generally determine either from blood, from urine, or from body tissues that can be elevated by the presence of one or more types of cancer. So the tumor marker that was mentioned here is the alpha-fetoprotein, or the AFP, which is generally associated with hepatocellular carcinoma. So based on the guidelines, generally AFP is actually included in some of the guidelines to be part of a screening test for patients who are at risk for HCC, but it's not used by its own. It's normally used together with the use of ultrasound, and imaging are what we consider to be the standard of care for the pickup of hepatocellular carcinoma screening in at-risk patients. Now, these at-risk patients, like what Kaina had mentioned, is also determined by whether or not they have evidence of cirrhosis on ultrasound, or in the absence of cirrhosis, whether or not they have hepatitis B. So, alpha-fetoprotein or tumor markers can be used in the diagnosis to complement what is already available and what is standard of care and criteria of the diagnosis of HCC. So HCC is diagnosed based on two main criteria, either what we know as the AASLD, which is the American Association for the Study of Liver Disease, or based on the Asia Pacific Association for the Study of the Liver. Now, in both criteria, AFP is actually not recommended as the confirmatory test, and diagnosis is based on imaging criteria. Now, how do we use AFP in the oncology setting is that they are generally used in the treatment evaluation, meaning we use it to also determine whether or not our treatments are working, and more importantly, in the follow-up after treatment or some definitive treatment, such as that of surgery. So that's what I would say. I am aware that sometimes screening outpatients actually use AFP, but just be mindful that this should not be a confirmatory test and should be used in conjunction with other imaging criteria as well.
So moving forward with the case segment, his initial laboratory results have returned. He has an AFP of 120, a liver function test shows normal bilirubin. However, there's an ALP of 140, ALT of 50, as well as an AST of 60. He also underwent a CT liver, a triphasic one to be specific, and it shows a lesion suspicious of hepatocellular carcinoma. So I think we've briefly talked a bit about some of the imaging criteria. Could we discuss or talk about what a triphasic scan is and why we require it specifically in this case?
So a triphasic CT is an imaging modality that includes mainly three phases. One is a non-contrast phase, an arterial phase, and the third would be a portal venous phase. So it's mainly used in the evaluation and the diagnosis of liver masses. And the typical imaging criteria of a HCC includes an early arterial phase enhancement and then a rapid washout, which then results in hypoenhancement relative to the liver itself in the portal phase or the delayed phase. So in the presence of a patient with risk factors like liver cirrhosis and or hepatitis B, and with such imaging features, this would be diagnosis of HCC based on the criteria that I mentioned above.
So could you diagnose a HCC without a biopsy? And are there other cancers which we can do the same as well?
Generally, for oncology, we always say no tissue, no issue. So we would always recommend for histology to be done. And it's seldom that we diagnose cancer without a biopsy. But in HCC, is one of those cancers that we can actually do that. Now, the diagnosis of HCC is made purely on imaging as well as the presence of risk factors. And it's reported based on a system called the LIRAD, the LIRAD. Where each of the lesions are assigned categorically based on their relative probability of benign versus malignant. So if a patient with high-risk features, such as that of presence of cirrhosis and hepatitis B, and has the occurrence of these CT imaging features, then obviously he or she would be diagnosed with HCC. Now, if the radiological findings are suspicious of a HCC, however, patient does not have any risk factors, this gets a little bit problematic. So I would say we normally discuss these cases at a multidisciplinary tumor board, and as well as to discuss the possibility of a histological confirmation. One of the things that we tend to be a bit concerned about is whether or not this could be an intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma as well, of which the treatment is actually very different as compared to HCC.
So, Dr. Kaina, if we may ask, why do HCCs behave in such a way radiologically?
That's a very good question, and it's important for us to understand why it shows this way. That's because there's differences in the blood flow between HCC tissues and the non-HCC liver tissues. During hepatocarcinogenesis, there's actually increased intranodular arterial supply, whereas for cirrhosis nodules or dysplastic nodules that's not HCC, they are usually hypoenhancing. They don't have this increased blood supply. So we show darker on the CT scan compared to the HCC lesions. This contrast helps us differentiate HCC from others. So then the washout phase is usually, there are a few reasons. One of the reasons is that during the portal venous or delayed phase of the scan, there's an early venous drainage of the contrast inside the tumor. And outside the tumor of the background liver, there's actually a retention of the contrast because of liver fibrosis or the liver cirrhosis as a background. Therefore, there's this contrast of washout in the later phase of the scan. Therefore, we have these combination features of arterial enhancement and washout, and plus sometimes there's a pseudocapsule, which gives us a high confidence of diagnosis of HCC from the imaging itself. But one thing we need to keep in mind is that arterial enhancement alone or washout alone do not really give you the diagnosis of HCC. You need to combine these together and combine a few features together, plus the clinical history to give you a confidence diagnosis from the imaging alone. One of the most common ones we see is hepatic adenoma and FNH, focal nodular hyperplasia. And other things that Evelyn just now mentioned is the intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma can be quite tough to differentiate. But in general, for any lesion more than 2 centimeters, CT or cross-sectional imaging with MRI or CT, both are very, very sensitive to diagnose the nature of the lesion. It's only when the tumor is a little bit smaller, when we do a surveillance, we pick up much earlier lesions, then it becomes tough. So for hepatic adenoma, it has a very strong association with OCP use. Therefore, it's usually seen in females and young females, in that matter. 3 to 5% of adenomas may undergo malignant transformation to become ECC later on, but it's a small population. For focal nodular hyperplasia, it is not uncommon, in fact. When we refer all the different types of liver nodules, FNH is one of the common ones we see, in fact. It is not associated with the OCP use. And to differentiate adenoma and FNH, MRI with a particular contrast called Primovist is very important because this particular contrast can show us hepatobiliary phase, which is important in differentiating these two lesions. For example, both lesions have arterial enhancement, but some of the FNH have this progressing enhancing central scar in the middle, which gives these typical features for diagnosis. FNH can be quite certain on the imaging MRI. Whereas in adenoma, they don't have such features. They usually appear hypodense in the hepatobiliary phase compared to FNH. So this is one of the way using MRI Primovist to diagnose small lesions that we're not sure. For cholangiocarcinoma, unfortunately, it's quite challenging. A lot of times we have to discuss with the radiologist personally based on patient history and all that to see what is the higher chance. Generally, it shows a minor peripheral enhancement in contrast to the ACC, which is a big enhancement in the whole of the ACC nodules. So cholangiocarcinoma have a peripheral enhancement that gradually goes into center, cause a centripetal enhancement. So this is one of the features of cholangiocarcinoma. However, it's not always seen. So other features on the imaging we can see is that there may be some distal bile duct dilatation, because it's cholangiocarcinoma, that everything adding up together will give you a confidence diagnosis. But as I said, it's quite tough. We need to talk to radiologists a lot of times.
So Kaina, I just want to ask, I mean, I'm not sure how much you know about this, because it may not be a fair question because you're not a radiologist, but Primovis, what's so special about it? I mean, it's what kind is it? Just a contrast, a kind of contrast, but specifically for the liver, why does it always come into play when a radiologist is trying to differentiate liver lesions?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So Primovist is different from other contrast in MRI, like normal gadolinium. So Primovist is called gadoxetate disodium, I think. So it is partially intracellular, partially extracellular. So the way that it's actually testing the function of the hepatocytes, right? If the hepatocytes is normal function, you should be able to integrate this as per normal based on different phases of the scan. But if it's ACC or other lesions, then it's not normal hepatocytes. Therefore, the retention of the contrast and later on will be different. That's why Primovis is very important. And the importance is at the hepatobiliary phase of the scan when we do the multiple phase and temporal sequence of it. That gives us a distinct feature to help us to diagnose different lesions.
So now Mr. Lee comes to clinic and we have to decide on treatment options for him. What are other investigation modalities that you need to do to stage the cancer and decide on what to do next?
I think typically we will first assess the patient's fitness, and this is through a series of both physical examination as well as to clinically stage the patient based on his child puke score. A good way to remind people how to remember the child puke score is the mnemonic ABCDE, which is albumin, bilirubin, coagulation, the presence of a distension, and then encephalopathy. So this is very important because for every patient, we must not forget that we are not just treating the disease, but we are treating the patient more importantly. And it's through these series of physical and biochemical assessments that we are able to assess the correct and appropriate treatment for that patient based on his or her ECOG status. With regards to imaging, we would recommend a full CT scan of the thorax. And if this is not already completed, mainly to assess for any metastasis. Generally, patients that are coming to us in the clinic have already had some sort of abdominal imaging already performed. And this should encompass the abdomen itself to see if there's any other metastasis elsewhere, be it in the kidneys or anywhere else in the peritoneum, although this is highly unlikely. For patients who are potentially resectable or even transplantable, these should be discussed at the multidisciplinary tumor board or particularly with the hepatobiliary surgeons for any chance of potential resection. So one more thing I'd just like to say, that one of the things that we do nowadays, especially for our advanced HCC patients, is that we actually would require an OGT to screen for varices. So things have actually changed over the years, and I'll talk a little bit about that later, but this is just one of the things that we do to determine treatment regimens as well in the advanced stage.
So Evelyn, just want to ask on that point that you just mentioned, the role of the OGD to look for varices, I presume is to stratify how bad the portal hypertension is. I mean, I may be wrong. I'm just guessing based on an educated guess. Is there another reason we do it?
Yeah, so so this is when we come to the most interesting part, at least for me, which is to talk about the treatment of HCC. And I think a lot have changed over the years. From the time that we had first-line treatment, which is thyroxine kinase inhibitors, which is commonly known as sorafenib. That's what we had used as the standard of care for treatment for a very long time. And this was actually discovered in 2008. And it was only 10 years later, I think in 2018, that we had another TKI called lenvatinib that appeared in the market. And it was only in the last 5 years that we have a super influx of different treatment regimens that are now used in the first-line treatment. One of the most common regimens that we use is something called the IMbrave 150 protocol, which is a combination of immunotherapy as well as bevacizumab, which is an anti-VEGF, so vascular endothelial growth factor. In this particular study, all patients needed to have at least a baseline OGD done for this patient, because they actually included only patients with no varices or treated varices. And therefore, we do not give patients who have varices this particular combination because of the risk of bleeding from bevacizumab itself. I just wanted to take a bit of time here to reiterate some basic principles as well. So in cancer treatment, we do have multiple drugs that we play around with. The first is always chemotherapy. That's what we commonly know. So chemotherapy kills good cells and bad cells, and it's kind of like just your blunt way of killing cancer. We don't really use chemotherapy in HCC just because they don't respond very well. Thyroxine kinase inhibitors are TKI. These are the ones that are anti-VEGF inhibitors, or receptors. Generally, these are the ones that we use in the treatment of HCC. And recently, in the last couple of years, there's been an explosion of using immunotherapy to treat hepatocellular carcinoma, just because of the way that we think that there's some chronic inflammation as well as autoimmune conditions that's on board. And to be honest with you, even now in the current studies, there are differentiations between the way that we treat someone with HCC due to hepatitis, as well as HCC due to, say, for example, other chronic disease like NASH or fatty liver. Of course, this is not standard, but there are subset analysis that actually talk about all these differences.
You know, Evelyn, it's nice to know that we're still needed to do the OGD. Because for a moment, we were starting to feel a bit redundant. You see, you don't need a tissue, right? So you don't need us to take any samples. Then you've got all these fancy medications that we have no idea how to pronounce, let alone prescribe, right? And then suddenly we ask ourselves, what's our role in this whole HCC business? Oh, then you said you need an OGD to look for very CC. So we're still needed. We don't feel as worthless as we felt.
I mean, another thing that we definitely need as well is the fact that you guys help us with a lot of the dysfunctioning and a lot of the decompression of the bilirubin obstructions. Now, these are very important because obviously bilirubin is one of the child puke scarring. And without the decompression keys and your ERCPs, I think that's going to be very, very difficult for us to give any treatment whatsoever. So definitely thank you for that.
I think we talked a little bit about the treatment options, but I think to just backtrack a little bit, we just want to ask, there are several criteria to plan treatment options for HCC, and a common one is the BCLC, which is the Barcelona Clinic Liver Criteria. Dr. Kaina, would you mind explaining what this is and how we use it practically?
Yes, so that's a very good question and it's a very relevant question. The BCLC staging system has been endorsed by major societal guidelines in gastroenterology or hepatology to stage HCC. So this is very different from other tumors. I think Evelyn may know that usually use TNM, that's HCC system for staging of the cancer. But the reason that we use BCLC rather than the TNM is because the function of the liver plays a very crucial role in terms of the treatment modality that can be recommended as well as patient's prognosis. And one of the good thing or interesting about a BCLC imaging staging system is that it not only tells you the stage of the disease, it tells you the prognosis as well as the treatment recommendations in each different stages. To explain it simply, stage A is early disease, includes all the solitary HCCs, one single lesion, regardless of size, or less than 3 nodules, each less than 3 centimeters, with underlying compensated liver disease or non-cirrhotic patients. Stage B is the intermediate stage. It includes multifocal HCCs that's outside the criteria for stage A, also with preserved liver function as well. Stage C includes HCC with portal vein invasion and or actual hepatic spread, which is the metastatic disease, both under stage C if there's preserved liver function. And stage D is the terminal stage. In this stage, regardless what is the tumor burden, the liver has decompensated at this point with either ascites, jaundice, or hepatic encephalopathy. So this is a terminal stage because when the patient's liver function is so poor, the prognosis is mainly determined by the liver itself rather than HCC at this point. So this is the BCLC staging system. And based on this staging system, there will be corresponding recommendations for the disease prognosis and the treatment modalities. So BCLC-A, which is the early disease, the treatment is usually aimed for cure. So the curative treatments are surgical resections, radiofrequency or microwave ablation, and liver transplantation. So liver transplantation is something that's a little bit different. It's not completely under stage A. I can talk about that a little bit later. Sorry. For patients under stage B, intermediate stage, a subset of the patient can still receive liver transplantation, but it has to fulfill very stringent criteria. Not all the patients in the intermediate stage are able to receive liver transplantation. But majority of the patients in this group will receive palliative treatment. It can be local regional treatments such as PACE, transarterial hemoembolization. And in patients with BCLC-C, the recommendation now is systemic therapy or certain local regional therapies such as Y90, selective internal radiation therapy. And for patients in BCLCD, because of poor liver function, the treatment will be completely palliative and the best supportive care without any therapy. One thing to take note about the BCLC staging is that based on the name, Barcelona Clinic Liver staging system, that is basically a criteria for patients in Europe where liver transplantation is far more common than our part of the world in Asia. So certain therapies that are recommended based on the BCLC criteria are based on the local expertise. For example, it takes a lot more than in Europe. And Y90, however, is a lot more common in Asia nowadays, and especially in centers with a good experience with the Y90 treatment. Hence, although Y90 set is not inside BCLC, it is one of the treatment options for our patients where transplant may not be available for them. And other treatment modalities such as stereotactic body radiation therapy like SBRT from Red Uncle is also getting more prominent in terms of one of the treatment options
for HCC, but it's also not inside the BCLC criteria. If we come back to the main point that multidisciplinary discussion is very important for patients with HCC because there are many different treatment options and each individual patient will have different clinical profiles combining the liver function, performance status, and the tumor burden. Hence, a personalized treatment is really crucial in HCC, and we should all vouch for that for our patients.
Can we ask, you know, who would be viable surgical candidates? And would it be worthwhile to resect lesions that do not fulfill the criteria for these lesions?
In general, patients with reasonable liver function, usually child's A and maybe early child's B, but not too much for portal hypertension. And in the stage A of the disease based on tumor burden are surgical candidates for treatment ACC, which is a curative option, and which is something we hope majority of our patients are able to receive curative treatment. But for patients who are in, for example, BCLC stage B, it is a very heterogeneous group. They just say it's multifocal disease, but what kind of multifocal disease? Multifocal can be multiple tumor lesions within one liver segment. It can be multiple liver lesions in two different liver lobes, left side and right side, and everywhere have liver nodules. And of course, the behavior of these two groups of patients are very different, even though they are both under stage B. So therefore, it's important to get surgical opinion in terms of resectability. We can't just shut the door of surgical resection for patients under BCLC-B. Therefore, come back to the point that MDT is very important as well. Whether it's worthwhile to resect lesions who do not fulfill criteria for these lesions, sometimes we do resect lesions outside of certain criteria. For example, the Milan criteria is usually used also for surgical resection other than liver transplantation. But if there is a single lesion, huge lesion in the liver, as long as the background liver function is pretty good, sometimes our surgeon do resection for this group of patients. So discussing with the surgeon is very important, even though the patient have huge liver tumor burden or not really inside the BCLC stage A.
I just want to add in a few points from a medical oncologist point of view. So I think generally we do offer surgery to patients that fulfill well-established criteria that are already available internationally. And each center does have its own threshold with regards to its comfort level based on the experiences of that center itself. One of the things that I personally feel a little bit difficult to answer is the role of adjuvant treatment after surgery. And that also ties in play as to whether or not I would advocate for a surgery to be done outside the established criteria. So what we call adjuvant chemotherapy or what we call adjuvant treatment is the option of treatment that prevents cancer from recurring. And one of the rare things about HCC is, unfortunately, we do not have any existing good adjuvant treatment for HCC, which also defines that the best curative treatment is still a definitive resection, of which the surgeon should have the confidence of getting clear margins and to get all the lesions resected. So we did try TKI in the adjuvant setting. That was a STORM study that was done many years ago, and unfortunately, that was a negative study. Within our center, in the National Cancer Center, we do have multiple clinical trials that we are running, trying to use adjuvant immunotherapy for the treatment of hepatocellular carcinoma. So we have been part of this international trial, and right now there are still no readouts for these studies. However, we are trying to find good adjuvant alternatives in order to prevent recurrence of HCC. With regards to local treatment like TACE or Y90 use, I would say that ultimately these are seen as a bridging treatment where essentially the definitive treatment is still surgery or transplant. And hopefully Y90 or TACE becomes a bridging treatment for patients to go for definitive transplant. Although we do see very good outcomes for our patients with Y90, And with the current trial that we have on board, we are actually using Y90 in combination with systemic treatment, like immunotherapy, for these patients who may not be a candidate for definitive surgery. Thank you.
Thanks, Evelyn, for bringing up that point. I was thinking to talk about it later as well as an advertisement, you know, for patients who have actually locally advanced disease where the treatment is really not very defined. Yes, so this combination of Y90 and systemic therapy is a very interesting combination because with the previous translational study, we did know after the patient received Y90, which is a form of radiotherapy, in fact, that's given through the artery. It does not have a lot of embolization, although one of the name of it is transarterial radioembolization, but it actually doesn't do the embolization part, meaning it doesn't choke off the arteries. They just deliver the radiation from there. Therefore, there's less of ischemia in the tumor afterwards. But what it does is this radiation particles inside the tumor cause a immune environment changes, where in certain type of HCC, the immune cells is usually outside, doesn't help to kill the tumor after Y90. They've been brought into the tumor and help to actively try to kill off the cancer. Therefore, that's why this concept of combining Y90 and systemic therapy with IO therapy to help after this enhancement of the immune environment near the HCC, then we use the IO therapy to help to kill off the cancer. So this is the rationale for this study, and I think it's really exciting for us to see the result of it. Yeah.
So in summary, at this point of time, curative treatment still include that of surgery, resection, and transplant. Ablation is an option for only a select few of patients where the tumor size, I believe, is small, less than 2 to 3 centimeters. Yes. And Y90 at this point of time is still one of the options, especially for patients who do not fulfill surgical criteria, where the bridging solution before they go for transplant. But for patients who are not transplant candidates, Y90 has been used also in the situation of advanced HCC, where we are toying with the idea of combining it with systemic treatment for both local, regional, as well as distant metastatic control.
So we've briefly talked about Y90. Dr. Kana, could you take us through some of the other forms of ablation? You've mentioned microwave ablation. How about some of the intra-arterial therapies, including chemoembolization or radioembolization?
Yes, so local regional therapies are basically commonly done, radiofrequency ablation, microwave ablation. These are different because these actually aim for cure. The reason is that usually for lesions less than 2 centimeters, if you treat the patients with RFA or microwave ablation, the chance of recurrence is pretty low after 5 years. That's how we define cure in general. But if the lesion is more than 2 centimeters, 2 to 3 centimeters, sometimes our friendly IR will help us to see what is suitable for ablation as well, which in certain cases, we do use that as a curative treatment as well, although the recurrence rate is a bit higher compared to those smaller lesions. So this is a different type of local regional therapy that's aimed for cure. Then the subsequent ones, the transarterial treatment is usually as a form of palliative treatment. But when we say palliative treatment, it's not really that we just treat and then see what's happening, you know, and as previously mentioned, that it's being used as a bridging treatment. The definition is that wait for transplant subsequently. And you can also use it as downstage treatment, meaning that when the big tumor after you give me transarterial treatment becomes smaller, then this patient can go for curative treatment, for example, resection after Y90, after TACE, and or RFA after Y90 and TACE and aim for cure. So this making a treatment combination is making it possible to improve our chance to cure HCC as well and reduce the recurrence rate. So for transarterial therapy, we mentioned TACE, which is transarterial chemoembolization. So this is what is done by IR, and the treatment is delivered via artery. And we try to select the arteries that's
feeding the HCC. As mentioned earlier on, HCC is a very arterially avid lesion. Once we found the artery that specifically select the tumor, a chemotherapy with a plus embolization agent will be delivered to choke off the artery, to cut off the blood supply to the tumor, therefore cause ischemia of the tumor, and therefore kill the cancer. So this is how TACE works. And what we aim to do is to select the arteries as distal as possible so that we don't cause ischemia of larger areas of the liver. And because of the mechanism of this treatment modality, one of the problems is post-TACE syndrome, where a patient may develop fever, leukocytosis, similar to infection, but actually it's because of ischemia of the tumor and the liver. And the other type of a transarterial therapy just now mentioned, which is YNI desert. As mentioned, that this is not really an embolization form of therapy, it's the delivery of the radiotherapy into the arteries. And one thing special about YNI compared to TACE is that it can be used for lesion with tumor with a portal venous invasion, and it has been shown good effect. TACE cannot be used for portal vein invasion because it can kill off the artery, where if it's in the big portal vein, then the part of the liver will die off, as we know that portal vein supplies majority of the liver blood supply. And so these are two forms of transarterial therapies. And other local regional therapies that's not very frequently being talked about, and especially to talk in medical school or to the residents, is something like SBRT, and where radiation oncology come into play. But of course, before that can be put into guidelines to be defined, and then we need to discuss which patients are more suitable for certain type of therapy in the MDT. And other type of therapy, for example, external beam RT has also been used, but of course, in only certain situations, not all the patients are fit for that as well.
So thanks, Kaina, for that nice summary of all the local regional therapies. So I just want to ask Evelyn a question. So, you know, there are so many different therapies, it seems, right? I mean, you have resection, you have ablation, you have local regional therapies, you have systemic therapies. Now, I think for curative purposes, the small lesions, surgery and ablation seems to be the way to go, right? And plus minus transplant, depending on whether they're cirrhotic or not. But when you're choosing a treatment strategy for the not so obvious candidates, that means someone who has disease that cannot be resected, they have potential metastasis as well. How do you decide who gets what? Because there seems to be many ways to combine all of these things. And is there a formula for the typical patient? Is there a way to individualize it? And what do you actually consider? I mean, these are all, I know, difficult questions, but in your experience when handling some of these patients, what is your general approach?
To be honest, I wish there was a formula that we can just input patient's age, patient's ECOG, and then immediately something will tell us what to use. But unfortunately, on the clinical side, we don't really have that automatism at this point of time. I think, like I mentioned before, HCC has come a very long way, and I need to give a big round of applause to all my researchers and all the clinicians internationally who have made such a big effort in making the option of HCC systemic treatment so much more robust than what we had in the past. In the first line, HCC treatment, right now, we do have the offer of what I mentioned, IMbrave 150, which is really the combination of immunotherapy plus the anti-VEGF inhibitor, bevacizumab. We also do have the combination of immunotherapy, dual immunotherapy. This is just recently published in, I believe, one of the big clinical papers. Study was called the Himalaya study, where they actually used two different immunotherapy agents to prime the immune system and subsequently fight off the HCC cancer cell itself. Of course, we have our very faithful TKI single agents, sorafenib and lenvatinib, to be used as options as well. And then after that, it's a bit of a rojak. So people try to mix and match different options together. For example, immunotherapy plus TKI, for example, the combination of whether or not such treatment options can actually go and play. But right now, we don't have any positive studies for that. We only have the positive studies of atezo plus bev, as well as dual immunotherapy. However, this has also changed the treatment protocols and the regimens and the landscape of advanced HCC, because there was overall survival benefit discussed in these patients who actually underwent the treatment of atezolizumab and bevacizumab as compared to standard of care at that point of time, which was sorafenib. And this overall survival benefit was actually at least more than 6 months, if I'm not mistaken, and it was between 19 months versus about a year. So this was for advanced HCC. So what people are trying to do nowadays is that now that we know that we have very clear treatment options for both end of the spectrum, patients who are resectable go for curative surgery, patients with metastatic disease go for systemic treatment, of which we have A, B, C, D, E. The question goes, what happens to those patients who are right smack in the middle, who have locally advanced disease but are not surgical candidates, who have small diseases, multinodular here and there, but then they cannot go for any definitive surgery. So what we have is that we have a combination of that for locally advanced treatment, as well as we add in early systemic treatment. And that's how we have the combination of Y90 plus tislelizumab and bev and so on and so forth. Now, I must say that all these combinations are done on a trial basis, which means these are not something that we offer upfront to every single patient just because there is no standard of protocol at this point of time. Secondly, something that I must bring into light is that we do have guidelines. Now, one of the things that sometimes I hesitate a little bit is because these guidelines are written by Americans. And like what I mentioned to you, HCC is an Asian disease. So we do have our own Asian guidelines for HCC treatments as well. And they have to be, it has to be something that, you know, we are also comfortable with on the ground, something that we use, for example, the inclusion of that of SBRT, the inclusion of that of Y90. And therefore, this is something that even though there are guidelines, a lot of the times we actually go based on the Asian guidelines or institutional practices. A third thing that I wanted to mention is that because of all these systemic treatments up front, we are also trying to bring all these potential regimens into the early setting. As you can see, based on the BCLC guidelines, most definitive treatments happen when a patient's ECOG status is good and when the tau-pupe status is optimized. And obviously, early treatment would be better for the patient as compared to if we let their liver function continue to deteriorate, then the options for treatment in the later stage would be a bit difficult. So always encourage early referral if necessary, and obviously to recruit patients on trials, especially if they're fit. Bearing in mind that all these treatments, even in the advanced stage, require patients to have good tau-pupe status. Treatments of the atezolizumab plus bev, or whether or not the dual IO, also require patients to have good tau-pupe scores. And we don't really have much option for patients once they deteriorate to the point that they are in the realm of liver dysfunctions. So it's always important to treat patients early in the course of the disease. One more thing I would like to say, wearing the hat from a health economist and a health equity point of view, recently in Singapore, we also published something called the cancer drug list. Honestly, for me, this is a great thing because that basically tells me that I can give you this drug simply because it's also subsidized by the government. So in the past, atezolizumab and bevacizumab was something that people had to pay upfront. And a lot of our patients didn't get the opportunity to use these drugs just because of how expensive they were. But recently, with the MOH implementation of the cancer drug list, these drugs are actually made available to all patients as long as they fulfill the criteria that is based on the trial. And these are all subsidized by our government as well.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kaina and Dr. Evelyn. I think this episode has really given us a great opportunity in understanding the perspectives of hepatocellular carcinoma from, you know, the viewpoint of a hepatologist, an oncologist, as well as from a health economist as well. So yeah, I just want to thank the both of you for joining us today. But before we conclude this episode, you know, could we just, you know, get, you know, a couple of take-home points for our listeners when dealing with patients with hepatocellular carcinoma?
Can I go first or Evelyn go first?
Yeah, why don't you go first, Hannah?
Okay. So, well, yeah, it's very good to have some take-home points. And I have three take-home points. Number one is, especially for junior doctors, all the cirrhosis and Hep B patients should have follow-up regularly to look for early HCC. As we know, early HCC is a time when cure is possible. Hence, picking up early is instrumental in their survival in the future. So please remember to follow up patients with liver cirrhosis and hepatitis B. And currently in Singapore, there is a cohort study called Elegant Study who recruit patients with risk factors for HCC, like cirrhosis and hepatitis B patients. They will get regular surveillance and also have blood tests, urine and stool tests being taken to look for better biomarkers to diagnose early HCC. So if you do have patients that may benefit from this cohort study, you can contact us for that as well. The second take-home message is that, as mentioned, HCC usually diagnosed from cross-sectional imaging, for example, CT or MRI. We don't really need histology to diagnosis. But AFP is not really a good marker for HCC. If you use that, 40% of HCC will be missed because they will have normal AFP. So combination of risk factors, family histories, cross-sectional imaging and blood tests, all these must take into consideration when we want to diagnose patients with HCC. Number three, multidisciplinary approach is very important. This is the key word, even if you take the exam, right? So MDT is very important. Come to ACC is even more important because local regional therapy is given by IR. Diagnosis, of course, recurrence is seen by radiologists. Red onco can give SBRT. Gastroenterologist will treat your underlying liver disease and optimize it before Evelyn takes over to give systemic therapy. And of course, oncologists will give you all the opportunities for trials, for patients, for these new medications, otherwise will not be affordable. So these are my three learning points, very important. HCC needs personalized treatment. You can't put them into buckets and you give them the same treatment.
For me, I think I just have three points as well. I think the first one is that HCC is an Asian disease. So whether or not you're in endocrine, whether or not you're in gastro, you're in GIM or any other subspecialty, you got to know HCC because you're going to see it in our patient population regardless. I think that's the first point. The second one is HCC has changed a lot over the years. So obviously now we have so much more options than what we had in 2008. And in the last 5 years, it's been an explosion of options. So keep your options open, keep your mindsets open. Patients are not as bad as they seen in the past. And I think this should be communicated to the patients in the most appropriate manner as well. Last and I suppose not least, yes, HCC, you do not need a histology. So if you suspect HCC, by all means, please refer to the medical oncologist or to any of the surgeons in the clinical suspicion of a HCC. I think this is important to know, partly because sometimes going for a diagnosis or going for a biopsy with the radiological evidence of HCC can actually delay the treatment for the patient and cause patients to actually undergo unnecessary procedures. I think these are the three main things I just wanted to bear in mind. Everything else, if you're ever interested in HCC and the treatment of cancer care, you're more than welcome to do a posting with medical oncology. I'll say that upfront. I think generally we are more than happy to take anybody who's willing to commit the time and the effort into learning more about and improving cancer care in Singapore. Thank you.
Thanks, Evelyn, as well as Kaina for coming to our show and giving us all this insight into this topic of HCC. Right? So you can refer to some of our older episodes. I think we did an episode 10 with Dr. Rajnish on hepatitis B, because HCC, hepatitis B, In our Asian setting, they are very closely linked. And the management of hepatitis B often has to take HCC into consideration. And as Evelyn mentioned, it's not an uncommon disease. It's an Asian disease and it's relatively prevalent in our population. So I think it's good for everyone to at least have some understanding of what this topic is all about. Right. So I hope the listeners have enjoyed the conversation and learned as much as we did. And if you could just take a look at our Padlet website, which is accessible via our landing page. If you just Google Linktree, so Linktree, you type Guts and Glory, it should appear as one of the first set of results. And then you can find show notes, infographics, reference articles for the topics that we've discussed. And again, we're honored that you're including us as part of your learning journey. So until next time, all the listeners, take care and stay safe.